Thank you, Judge Berger. My name is Ann M. Corella, attorney registration number 40834. I represent Alan Colwhite on appeal. I'd like to reserve approximately 3 to 4 minutes for rebuttal. An essential feature of a fair trial is that the trial court must correctly instruct the jury as to all matters of law. Another essential feature of a fair trial is that those instructions must convey to the jury that it is the prosecution's burden to prove the defendant's guilt as to the charged crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. Those are well-settled legal principles. Those principles don't change when there is an affirmative defense. An affirmative defense in Colorado we call is treated as if it's another element of the crime. We tell the jury that the state has the burden to prove the guilt of the defendant as to the affirmative defense. In other words, disprove the affirmative defense or prove that the affirmative defense is inapplicable. All of these are, there's some complication sometimes, I think, for juries in understanding the turnaround from proving to disproving, but the point is that it's critical that the jury at all times understands what the burden of proof is, where to apply it, and who bears it. I raised three instructional errors in Mr. Colwhite's brief. I'm happy to discuss any of them. I'm focusing on issue one because it so obviously raises an issue fundamental to a fair trial. Here, the jury was not properly instructed as to the burden of proof as it related to the affirmative defense. This error was obvious. It affected a substantial right, and it was outcome determinative.
Do you have any Colorado authority for the proposition that the instruction that you claim should have been given has to be given?
What I have is the statute, which is very clearly set out. The statute for the affirmative defense here sets out not only the affirmative defense, but it also sets out the exceptions to the affirmative defense. And then that would be 18.1704. 18.1407 explains the burden of proof as to affirmative defenses. There's no differentiation between the exceptions and the actual tenets of the affirmative defense. So,
is there anything either in the 2008 or 2014 pattern?
Yes,
jury instructions that addresses this?
I agree with you in Castillo, where you mentioned that the 2014 jury instructions actually make it somewhat clearer. But the 2008 jury instructions are very clear that the instruction appears as one, that you have the tenets of self-defense, you have also the exceptions. And following that is the state's burden of proof. It's always accompanied by the state's burden of proof. I think the problem becomes when you get into situations where you have, for whatever reason, the instructions are broken up into multiple instructions, and then the jury is told, well, this particular thing is the affirmative defense. We apply this burden here, this burden here, this burden here, and you have an instruction floating out there that has no burden of proof associated with it. And we ask the jury to make some sort of decision on its own as to what the burden of proof is.
But, counsel, sorry to interrupt.
No problem.
Isn't it a well-accepted principle that we read the instructions as a whole?
Absolutely,
Judge Navarro. So why does it matter whether the instructions are on one piece of paper or five pieces of paper?
I think it matters, Judge Navarro, when we have them on multiple pieces of paper and we have different areas, different ways of telling them the burden of proof. In other words, we have different instructions that set it out. We don't just have one, we have many. So we have an elemental that has the burden of proof following, and it has the elements. It has the elements, and then it has the burden of proof following it. It also mentions what the affirmative defense is. Here, the elemental set forth the elements of second-degree assault. It also said, without the affirmative defense, in instructions 20 and 21. So it isolated these two instructions, as 20 and 21, as the affirmative defense. Okay. Then later on, the jury gets an instruction 20 then that sets forth, this is the affirmative, the evidence in this case has raised an affirmative defense. and the affirmative defense, the prosecution has the burden to prove the guilt of the defendant as to the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt. Then the next instruction is the affirmative defense in this case is self-defense. Those can be read together. I think the problem becomes then when you start throwing additional sentences from what would normally be considered part of the affirmative defense, or at least one of the known exceptions to the affirmative defense, and you have them, elsewhere, and you have no burden of proof associated with them, we tell ourselves that the jury, we assume the jury follows the instructions of the court. The instructions of the court told the jury to apply the burden of defense to the elementals, and it told the jury to apply the burden to the affirmative defense. Nothing in the instruction that stands alone on its own about initial aggressor that says a person is not justified in using physical force if he is the initial aggressor. Nothing in that instruction leads one back to the affirmative defense in an instruction kind of way. Nothing leads it back to affirmative defense, and nothing leads it back to the elementals. It's none of those things.
But the affirmative defense is about, the use of physical force.
Mm-hmm.
So why doesn't that connect the affirmative defense instruction, which does have the reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt language in it, why doesn't the physical force subject matter connect it to the later instructions, which mention when a person can use physical force in self-defense?
It doesn't, Judge Navarro, it doesn't connect it because it's not explicit. It's not an actual, physical force is a fact in the case. It simply is a fact in the case. I can give you an example just from, if we took an elemental and we took one of those elements out, separated it out. So if we have second degree assault causing, a serious bodily injury with a deadly weapon, and we normally would lay out all the elements of that crime and say the prosecution has this burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt as to each of the elements. If you told the jury, well, okay, let's take all of those elements but one, and you just took one of those elements out and put it on another page, and so you said, hey, jury, these are the elements. Defendant, state of Colorado, with intent to cause bodily injury, cause serious bodily injury. And the state has the burden of proving that beyond a reasonable doubt. And then you have another page where you have an instruction that basically says, regarding the serious bodily injury, the defendant must have used a deadly weapon. And there's no burden of proof attached to it, nothing. We wouldn't let that happen. And indeed, in this case, for instance, there was an interrogatory about whether or not Mr. Groney was at risk. That interrogatory, which is clearly a part of this case, clearly a part of the self-defense, clearly we know who we're talking about, that interrogatory is accompanied by a burden of proof. We always tell the jury that this particular fact must be proved beyond reasonable doubt. So I think when you start parsing them out and you start telling them this applies here, this applies here, this does not apply here, you run into an issue when you start breaking up the instructions that way.
Counsel, I think you've made very clear your argument as to why this was not the right instruction. I guess what I'm focused on is the plain part of plain error here.
Sure.
I think we've established there isn't any case that was announced at the time of defendant's trial that had specifically reversed on this particular issue. Is that right?
Not on this particular issue. Certainly it's the well-settled legal principle of we must inform the jury. Right?
Of course. And but you mentioned that the 2008 pattern instructions, where they set everything out on a single page,
yes,
would have been, had that instruction been given here, would we be talking about this today?
I don't think we would be. No, I think that pattern instruction, if the pattern instructions must mean anything, they must mean that we are trying to avoid plain error by giving these instructions. If they had given that pattern instruction where all it was the exceptions to self-defense, everything was in one instruction and it was accompanied by a burden of proof, then yes, I think we wouldn't be here talking. But since one instruction became essentially four instructions in this case, The likelihood of it becoming confusing to the jury and for the jury to look at that one particular instruction having to do with initial aggressor, which is clearly disputed in the case, the whole case hinges on it. When they look at that, you know, they need to understand that, you know, that it needs to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's possible that they even looked at that and thought, maybe Mr. Conlight has the burden now to tell us that he was not the initial aggressor, because it's not accompanied by anything, and you have other ones that are.
How do the instructions here compare with the 2004 pattern instructions?
I actually don't know the answer to that in terms of the 2004 instructions. I didn't look up the 2004 instructions simply because the 2008 instructions were relevant at the time.
And how did it compare with the 2008 instructions?
The 2008 instructions, again, were all one instruction. So the tenets of self-defense were set out, but also it was accompanied by the instruction, by the exceptions. And then following all of that was the state's burden of proof with respect to the affirmative defense.
I know you want to save some time. Quick question on
sure.
another issue, he was not where he had a right to
yes,
be.
Yes, right.
Was there any argument at trial here that even if the defendant wasn't the initial aggressor, he wasn't where he had a right to be, and therefore he couldn't invoke self-defense?
No, there was no explicit argument about that, Judge Boat, but there was an argument that it was very clear Mr. Conlight was not invited to belong after a certain point. And he certainly, that wasn't his car, that wasn't anything. And I do want to convey and clear up one thing, that there was a little bit of argument about Mr. Conlight's ability to leave the car.
Yes.
And we disagreed over some portion of that. But I also do want to say that about 50 pages after the citation in the answer brief, there is a moment where it is elicited that Mr. Groney, he explains, well, he couldn't leave the car unless it was from the outside. So I do want to say that. But I still think that brings up issues that in terms of retreat, in terms of inside the car. I mean, he wasn't pinned to the ground in the car. He was in, you know, there was a car to move around it. And that also brings up issues of retreat outside of the car too. But no, nobody explicitly argued that. And I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if that's okay.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes and I think 13 seconds left.
May it please the court. My name is Jacob Lofgren, registration number 40904, and I represent the appellee, the people of the state of Colorado. The people respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment of conviction because the instructions provided here on self-defense were sufficient. The defendant addressed the first issue, so I'll focus my argument on that issue as well, but I'm happy to answer questions on either of the other issues if this court has them. This case involves a defendant who assaulted and severely injured a 60-year-old limo driver because that limo driver simply asked him to get out of the back of the limo. That limo driver was never the initial aggressor. The defendant was the initial aggressor. As an initial matter, the people point out that all of the jury instruction claims raised on this appeal were not preserved below. So any review here is only for plain error, and that's an important distinction here. Because while the people agree that the pattern 2008 instruction would have been a more clean instruction in this case, the defendant never objected to the instructions that were given. So the
Is there any indication in the record why the court just didn't give the pattern instruction?
The record is pretty woeful as to the jury instruction conferences in this case. They were all done off the record, so we have no indication of who presented what instructions, how they came to be broken up, why they didn't follow the patterns. All we know is that no one objected to the instructions as they were given.
And just to follow up on that, Mr. Lofgren, the trial court gave both parties the opportunity to place any objections on the record, is that correct?
That is correct, and there were no objections. There might have been objections to other instructions, but certainly none to the self-defense instructions.
Thank you.
In this case, the district court was not required to give a special instruction that the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was the initial aggressor. And that's the instruction that the defendant is requesting here. As I mentioned, the uncontroverted facts show that the defendant was the initial aggressor.
Could we talk about that for a minute? I know in your answer brief you made the point that it's not enough just to say fighting words, if you will, to make you an initial aggressor. But the reply brief, I thought, pointed out that our definition of self-defense in the statute says it's justified where a person reasonably believes the use of physical force has been employed or imminent use of physical force will be employed. Does that suggest that the person who puts another in fear of imminent physical force could in fact be the initial aggressor, even if he or she didn't in fact strike the first blow?
I do think the case law is maybe not perfectly clear on that point. For the most part, the cases seem to indicate words alone are not enough to allow a defendant to exercise self-defense. But in certain instances, it might be possible that words could be enough, but it would be something more than what we have here. For instance, do you want to step outside or I'm going to beat you up? Something that's directly indicating that the person uttering the words is about to use force. In this case, we don't have that.
Well, didn't the victim say something to the effect, I'm going to put you out of the car, and then he moved back towards the car and opened the door and stuck his head in? Doesn't that suggest he's about to physically put his hands on the defendant and put him out of the car?
My first response to that, Your Honor, would be that the record isn't clear that the victim ever said, I'm going to put you out of the car. That was heavily contested, and a huge portion of the cross-examination was spent going back and forth between defense counsel and the victim as to the exact wording of what he said when he told the defendant to get out. Even assuming that he said, I'm going to put you out of the car, the victim explained that if I said that, I was not indicating any threat. All I was telling him is it's time to get out. I'm tired of you harassing this female passenger. You need to get out and find a different way home.
But don't we have to look at it from the defendant's point of view, not what the victim intended, but what the defendant could have perceived reasonably from that statement?
That's true, Your Honor, but there's no evidence here that the defendant perceived that to mean that he was in any physical harm. The defendant didn't testify at trial.
But the jury could infer that from the statement that Judge Vogt was referring to, couldn't they? That this guy was about to come around the side and grab onto him and throw him out of the car. Couldn't the jury infer that from the evidence that was presented?
Even if that was possible, the instruction here was still not incorrect. So I guess the best response I can give you, Your Honor, is even assuming that was the case, that the jury inferred that I'm going to put you out of the car meant I'm about to cause some harm to you, the instruction here on initial aggressor still did not require a special indication that the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was the initial aggressor. The other instructions provided in this case sufficiently covered that point. The general burden of proof instruction provided at the start of the instruction said the prosecution has the burden with respect to every element of the offense. The affirmative defense instruction further made that clear by stating the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant's guilt even as to the affirmative defense. So it was clear that the prosecution bore the burden to prove every element of the offense and to disprove every element of self-defense. Nothing in the instructions ever suggested that that burden was any different with respect to the initial aggressor.
But when the pattern instruction would have solved this problem, obviously the trial judge had available the pattern instruction. Why doesn't that lead to the conclusion that the error was plain, if in fact it was at all confusing as to what the jury had to find in order to find him guilty?
I don't think it was confusing. The jury was still instructed on every... Let me step back. The pattern instruction does put the four instructions that were provided here into one single instruction. The jury in this case still received every part of that pattern instruction, just separated out over the span of four instructions. So it's not as if they missed some part of the pattern instruction in instructing the jury, they just broke it out.
No, but their argument is that by breaking it out, it was not obvious at all, maybe not even clear in any sense, that this one critical fact that the jury had to find or not find was governed by the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. That's their argument, as I understand it. And it just seems to me that argument could have been completely avoided if the court had simply given the pattern instruction. So why isn't that plain error?
It likely could have been avoided had the court given the pattern instruction. I'm not going to dispute that with the court. But it wasn't plain error because the jury still received every aspect of that pattern instruction separated out over the span of four instructions. And those instructions still were placed in close proximity to each other, in fact, four in a row. And the general burden of proof instruction, as well as the general affirmative defense instruction, still said the prosecution carries the burden. There's nothing that said that separated out the initial aggressor instruction from those other instructions and said, you're special, the defendant carries the burden on you, or you're special, you don't, the prosecution doesn't have the burden.
So if I'm the juror, if I'm a juror, I say, okay, this inquiry is part of self-defense, and I've been told that self-defense has to be disproved by the state beyond a reasonable doubt. So therefore, I must conclude that this element of initial aggressor similarly must be disproved. Is that the thought process that you want or expect the jury to go through?
Yes, and I think that's consistent with the case law. The case law says that we presume that the jury follows the instructions as they're given and reads them as a whole. In this case, if they followed them as they were given and read them as a whole, their understanding should have presumably been that the burden of proof as to the initial aggressor rested with the prosecution.
Mr. Lofgren, have you read the People versus Castillo case that the defense supplemented with last week? So I guess two questions for you, and I'll probably ask the defense counsel the same question. How does this similar or different from Castillo, this case? And in particular, I noticed that in Castillo, the court said that they were found useful or relevant that in closing argument, the defense counsel explicitly argued that the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was the initial aggressor. So did that happen here in closing argument? And looking back at the instructions more generally, how similar or different are the instructions here to those in Castillo?
As far as I recall, there was no argument in closing argument that said the prosecution had the burden with respect to the initial aggressor. It really wasn't a huge part of the closing arguments of either party as to who was the initial aggressor. It was referenced, certainly, but the question was more whether the words uttered by Mr. Groney were sufficient to make him the initial aggressor. As far as the instructions that were provided in Castillo, the question, as it relates to this issue, is that in that case, the defendant tendered the instruction that's being requested here. He tendered an instruction that said, the prosecution bears the burden to prove that the defendant is the initial aggressor. And the court rejected it in Castillo. And this court found that that was not error. Rejecting the exact instruction being requested here was not error. Taking Castillo to its application in this case, you certainly can't have plain error when that instruction is never requested and the defendant requests it for the first time on appeal. Does that answer your question sufficiently?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, the people respectfully request.
Actually, I'm sorry, I have a question on the third issue, the no duty to retreat question. If we disagree with you that the evidence could permit a finding by the jury that the victim was the initial aggressor, essentially, do you lose? I mean, what if we disagree with you on that point? You seem to hang a lot on the fact that, or on the allegation that the evidence showed only that the defendant was the initial aggressor, no reasonable person could conclude otherwise, so therefore no plain error on that last issue. What if we disagree with your analysis?
There's actually two steps to determining whether the no duty to retreat instruction could have constituted plain error. It was certainly wrong. The people don't dispute that. Under Toler, the instruction was wrong. But even if the defendant was not the initial aggressor, the evidence in this case did not give any potential for retreat. And if the evidence doesn't give a potential for retreat, any error in the instruction couldn't have caused harm because the jury had no reason to believe he had an ability to retreat.
Okay, but help me out here, because aren't there really three parts here? First, was he, could he potentially, maybe he wasn't the initial aggressor. Well, and the jury's thinking, okay, and maybe he really didn't have anywhere to retreat, but they're looking at this instruction and it says, and he was where he had a right to be. Couldn't they think, well, you know, he didn't have any right to be in this limo, so even if the other two are positive, if you will, he still loses because he wasn't where he had a right to be. Recall in Toler, that was the issue, because they were saying, well, Toler's a trespasser, and regardless of whether he's the initial aggressor, he wasn't where he had a right to be. And I thought that was kind of where defense counsel was going on the third issue. She can clarify that.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, but I think the steps are taken out of order there, because I think where to follow defendant's argument logically, you have to say the jury concluded that the defendant was not the initial aggressor, and then the jury concluded he was not where he had a right to be, and because of that, they concluded he had to retreat. In this case, he did not have the ability to retreat anywhere, so it does not matter that the instruction was incorrect.
And that's because the door had to be opened from the outside?
Right, and there actually, in my brief, I identified one location in the record where that's clear, but in prepping for our oral argument, I found five locations, and I'm happy to share those with the court. January 11th at page 226, January 12th at pages 85, 117, 174, and 216. And what I found particularly interesting about that is four of those were actually defense counsel's cross-examination of witnesses where he was foreclosing that any of these doors were available for retreat. It was almost as if during cross-examination, defense counsel was preventing any attempt by the prosecution to say the defendant could have retreated and didn't.
Well, can I ask you the obvious follow-up question? I think it's obvious. If this is all true, that retreat wasn't an issue, why was the prosecutor discussing retreat in the rebuttal closing argument?
It was very brief, and when I was re-reviewing that closing argument, what struck me is there was never a discussion of retreat with respect to inside of the limousine. All of the discussions of retreat in opening statement and rebuttal closing argument dealt with what happened after they were outside of the limousine and fighting on the pavement. The prosecutor's reference was specifically with regard to the defendant's closing argument. In defendant's closing argument, he said, hey, look, I tried to retreat when she pulled me off and he started swinging at me, so I had a reason to go back at him. Prosecution, in its rebuttal, simply clarified that's not exactly what happened. He didn't attempt to retreat when he was pulled off. He went to get his hat because the female who was in the limousine had kicked it away in order to try and give some time for her and the victim to get back in the limousine. Any discussion of retreat here in opening or closing had nothing to do with what happened inside the limousine at the beginning of this fight. It was a discussion of what happened towards the very end of it. If there are no further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
Just briefly, Judge Navarro, let me answer your question, the difference between the instruction here and the instruction in Castillo. The instruction in Castillo, absolutely, we've agreed this is plain error. This was not a situation where we tendered any instruction. But the difference in the instructions is remarkable between this case and Castillo. In Castillo, the instruction was actually probably even better than the 2008 model jury instructions. It set forth the entire self-defense, including the exceptions. And so that's again, I go back to the same thing over and over, but that is the difference between that case and this case. And I think, you know, initial aggressor was absolutely an issue here. And I want to actually, from Castillo, repeat something that Judge Berger wrote there, which is that, you know, we stress that our role is not to determine whether the evidence that supports the instruction also supports a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant was the initial aggressor. the determination whether a defendant was in fact the initial aggressor, and the resolution of conflicting testimony on that issue was a question of fact for the jury to decide. It is a question of fact. When it's a question of fact, we expect the jury to be properly instructed on that question. This jury was not properly instructed. The fact that, you know, the burden of proof exists in one spot does not help. Here, we had the jury referred to the elements, and they were told that the affirmative defense was 20 and 21. That's it. If they wanted to actually find that the initial aggressor instruction was somehow part of that, that meant they defied the instructions that they were given, and we assume that they did not do that. The only other thing I want to say is that there was potential for retreat. There could have been a juror who assumed that he could have gone somewhere else in the car.
But didn't defense counsel explicitly argue multiple times that there was no opportunity to retreat?
He argued that, yes, there was nowhere for him to go in the car. He never addressed what happened outside of the car in the sense of retreat. I agree that that the prosecution actually addressed that, but retreat was an issue in the case. I think that's true.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and we will issue a written decision.
Thank you.